This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. I've been lucky to have had some great student interns work with me on Yin Radio. Most recently, Anna Maria Roque spent all of last year as an assistant producer, creating stories, doing interviews, and writing essays. Much of her work hasn't aired on Yin Radio yet, so today we're going to bring more of Anna Maria's work to light, along with some pieces you might have heard before. All of the pieces for today's show were produced by Anna Maria. And there's a second theme in today's segments: feminism. Feminism is the belief in equality of people, all people, independent of gender. Today's pieces all tackle that topic head on. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and the theme is Anna Maria Presents Strong Women. Jennifer Baumgardner and Amy Richards teamed up when they were in their early 20s, and they were working at Ms. Magazine at the time. Together, they went on to launch what's called Third Wave Feminism through their widely recognized book, Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. Amy Richards went on to found the Third Wave Foundation, and together, the women have authored a second book and founded a lecture agency called Soapbox, Inc., Speakers Who Speak Out. Yin Radio's Anna Maria Roque interviewed Jennifer Baumgardner and Amy Richards in spring 2009.
Taking a little breather from their cramped two-day itinerary at the University of Idaho, feminist activists and writers Amy Richards and Jennifer Baumgardner sat down with me for a little chat. The two women have come a long way since they met as 22-year-olds at Ms. Magazine. For almost two decades, Richards and Baumgardner have been prominent voices and go-to people for the women's movement. Their work has appeared anywhere from Harper's Magazine to Glamour, and in addition to speaking at more than 260 colleges, they've made appearances on shows such as The O'Reilly Factor and Oprah.
This is Amy Richards.
This is Jennifer Baumgardner.
We're just here visiting the University of Idaho. We've been here for the last 24 hours and gotten to meet lots of different people and gotten to be a part of the good vibe here. But we're writers and activists who live and work in New York City primarily. We're parents of young children. And close friends.
Good. How did you get started? I mean, as a 22-year-old at Miss.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I think, I'll speak more for myself. This is Amy. I didn't think that I'd be where I am, and so I think that the path sort of keeps appearing in front of me, and yet I've made very deliberate choices, and so in some ways I'm creating that path, I think it's been a combination of very hard work and tenacity and aggressiveness and being unapologetic and at the same time being thoughtful and sensitive and sort of constantly balancing that. When we wrote Manifesta, which was kind of wrote it in 1997, '98, '99,
yeah.
And then it was published in 2000, I definitely felt like I was coming to that project more as an activist. I had co-founded the Third Wave Foundation, and through that experience, and then later through Ask Amy, which is an online advice column at Ask Amy at feminist.com, I was in touch with so many people who were kind of inspired by feminism but confused about feminism, and so many people that were doing gestures that I would call feminist, even though they might not call feminist, like the WTO, or, you know, starting a transgender youth program, or a needle exchange program for, you know, young women specifically, or working on prison reform, or working on young women to get better access to birth control. I mean, sort of the myriad of issues, and I was calling it feminist, whether or not they were. And so saw myself coming to that project manifesto as more as an activist, having witnessed those projects, and wanted a platform to expose those projects to more people, both because I felt that work needed attention, but also because I knew that work would be inspiring to other people looking to get involved and looking to care about feminism in a deeper way. And it, through that process, and I had done writing before, but it was through that process that I both personally felt more connected to writing, and I began to value writing more as a medium with which to express the activism in my life and the activism in other people's lives, and, you know, see them very much as one now, the writing and the activism.
Your background or academic background is in art history, right?
I just have a BA in art history, and thought that I was going to go on to do something with art history, but it was before I graduated from college that I realized I wasn't going to do something explicitly with art history, because I was in my senior year of college and I was working on my thesis, which was about comparing images of, I was going to do something on Nicolas Poussin and this painting and sort of talk about 1600 French painting. And then in the midst of it, the Rodney King verdict happened. I got really involved, started doing this cross-country voter registration drive, and I was like, I can't write about this esoteric French painting. Like, that feels so meaningless to me. But found a way to bring my politics more to my thesis and compared images of Queen Elizabeth I in England, where women could rule, to Maria de' Medici in France, who could not rule except by, if their children were too young, so they couldn't inherit the throne in their own right, and looking at how images reflected the role of women in those countries. And so it became something. That said, I think art history was an amazing major because it taught me how to research. It taught me what a primary source was, like in this way that like I would have to seek out these like documents, I would have to find translators that I trusted to come with me and read the thing in Italian to me or read the thing in French to me. And because translation is so key to understanding things, and we were talking about this earlier today, like the Vatican is providing one interpretation of Catholic doctrine, but you go back and read for yourself and you're like, I don't take from that at all what the Vatican takes from it and how important translation is. Also how to be a writer, you know, and how to make an argument politically. I think that art history, I very much learned that. And it when you're studying art, you're studying religion, you're studying culture, you're studying class and economics, you're studying gender, you're studying race. And so I think that it now makes perfect sense that that's what I did. But kind of quickly knew that I was not going to do anything with my art history degree. And I remember I got an honor in my major, and I felt so phony accepting it. I was like, I don't know if I should accept this. And everybody was like, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
Do you still do anything with art today? Like, do you have art in your house? Or?
Yeah, but not. I've never been an artistic person. I'm a creative person, I think. And I aesthetically like art, but I wouldn't say that I've ever been an artistic person, yeah. But backing up, because the jobs I had when I was in high school, I worked for Senator Ted Kennedy, and very much was like pushed into that job by my mom, but got there, and I was like, oh, I like this, and I worked in the press office. And so I got to go out and like be with the senator and come to town and look at all the press clips and talk to reporters. And then when I was in college, I started working in a law firm initially, and then I worked at the press office of Christie's Auction House. And I took the press office jobs because they were the only ones like available. But then in hindsight, I realized, I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. That like, I was doing these things that I thought I was doing for other reasons, but I was in the press office.
All subconscious.
Yeah.
How about you? You're back.
Well, my jobs were a little more, I would say, average than Amy's, like, before that. Like, I worked at The Limited, or I worked at Olive Garden, or I worked at Jerry Sweaters and Swimmer, this local, you know, retail thing, and worked at a coffee shop, and stuff like that. Those were my jobs when I was in high school and college. So when I moved to New York City at age 22 and started interning at Ms. and then started writing, within a year had like a published clip in Ms., so in a national magazine, that was like a pretty big shift from my work experience. Although having any work experience translates in some ways.
And have I didn't have to go to Ms. to apply for the...
But I didn't have any office experience. That's definitely one of the things where we really differed at that age. So when I got to Ms., I really had never used a fax machine before. There were a lot of skills I just had to pick up within, like, 10 minutes of being there, but they were pick-upable, and it was good. And I'm sure my retail and restaurant experience helped me in ways that I'm probably not even totally cognizant of. I mean, I can make chit-chat, or I can sell things, or, you know, whatever. And then I had a theater background, too, and I think that, again, helped in some ways because I did start, even when I was pretty low at Ms., I did start doing TV appearances on behalf of Ms., and I was really comfortable, and the producers really liked me, and I got asked back a lot, and I think it was based on the fact that I could take direction, or whatever. These experiences that I had as a young person were enabling me to do maybe a better job in this new experience. But just the inverse of what Amy was saying about Manifesto, we did come together sort of seeing ourselves differently than we do now. And we certainly mutually influenced each other a lot, but I did see myself as a writer, as a professional writer by the time we started doing Manifesto. I had written for 10, probably, national magazines and was very unaware of the ways in which I was being an activist, probably, and had less less of a breadth of experience than she had, but like looking back, I had been working on these things since childhood, had been working on activist-y things, but had a hard time, or maybe, you know, maybe I even sort of thought, well, one of us has to be one thing, one has to be the other, not realizing how much we could both be both things and mutually mentor each other, I guess. And so by the time Manifesto was kind of done and we'd gone through this whole process together, I think I felt much more confident in my ability to identify myself as an activist, probably. And then, like Amy, much more aware of using writing as a tool for transmitting ideas that I had, as opposed to just like maybe finding a good story. I mean, I think the finding a good story is so essential, but I kind of saw the like larger purposes that maybe could motivate my writing. And then definitely all of the places that I've written for, pretty much, I mean, there's some definitely some dumb stories out there, but I did write the feminist-y story for that publication or for that month or whatever. And so I felt like I was creating this niche for myself that I could believe in, and in some way becoming a go-to person around these kinds of issues as a journalist.
And also, I mean, this woman, Susan Dominus, is a writer. She recently talked to a group of students we were hosting, and she said this, and I think this is true of you, because when you start on the editorial side, you have a lot of relationships with other editors.
Oh, totally.
And then when you go on to be a writer, you have that, because a lot of writing is relationship building. It's not everything, but a lot of it is that. And so you have the ability to call up and say, oh,
a lot of placing pieces is, that's for sure.
But I think that was something, too, that, again, you weren't, like, working at Ms. knowing you were going to leave, but it was, like, a skill that really benefited.
Yeah, it was good that I worked at Ms.
Yeah.
For sure, because I did know writers and I knew editors, or a few, you know. And then there was this like short period of time of leaving Ms. before I got my first assignment for another magazine. That was sort of scary, because it was like there was this like gulf of like nothing, you know. And then I think and a lot of no's and stuff like that. And then I think within a period of like 2 weeks, 6 weeks into it, but it felt like 10 years into it, I got 3 assignments in a row for features.
Oh, nice.
And then things started like moving forward a little bit better from there. Although being a writer is a great career, but it's a very erratic career in a lot of ways. And so you're always like completely, which is another reason I like the fact that we've really aligned professionally and also then expanded our revenue streams, as I keep saying lately. Mm-hmm. Because just writing, you're really at the whims of the editors and then the top editors, and things can get cut at any time, and you get paid like so much later than when you wrote the piece, and the piece changes a lot, and there's a lot of little betrayals that goes into being a writer.
And there's a favorite writer that always comes along. Like, we have to get this person to write now.
And so you're in luck if you get to be that person for a while, but then it can just as easily go away. So I think that there's a lot of, there's just a lot of instability attached with it. Or you get, you know, all the revisions back, and you're like, oh, now my week is ruined because I have to do this piece again. And I remember feeling when I was doing writing more exclusively and not doing other things, feeling like really up on days that I got approval or a piece got through or I got an assignment, and really extremely depressed on the days that something was going wrong. Some of that could have been youth, and like now I'm a little more inured to those emotions, but I think some of it was like, yeah, because now my week financially is screwed up, and you know, and I feel rejected, and I feel like everyone hated the piece, and it ties up so much with your identity.
Yeah. So how did this friendship form? I mean, did you just click, or is it?
No, I mean, it was over time. I mean, it was definitely sort of like we were the same age. We were working in the, you know, in offices down the hall.
Yeah, I don't remember the first social thing we ever did.
I don't remember either. I don't know. I mean, I don't remember the first thing, but there was a lot of just
like
being in the...
But it must have been like because we went to the Madonna concert all together and all hung out at that bar afterwards.
Is that 93?
So I was already feeling, it might have been early 94. I thought it was fall of 93.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is so long ago now, but I think we met pretty quickly, but our offices were down the hall, and they weren't that integrated. Like, Gloria Steinem's office was not, even though we had to deal with it all of the time, it was not integrated editorially into Ms. Magazine at all. And so Amy and my relationship became a conduit for her ideas to get into the magazine. She ended up being this really influential person, but it did in some ways really come together, even though you had great relations with all the editors, with our special friendship, because I could, like, directly be like, okay, Amy Richards went to this meeting, this happened, and this story should come out of it, or whatever. And so she was, like, kind of my, you know, my a source, like a major source.
And then the decision to write the book together, I mean, we'd clearly had, like, an established friendship by that point. Mm-hmm. And we're also doing, like, we were hosting dinner parties that were more crazy and with more work friends, or mm-hmm. kind of combining our work friends and our personal friends, and, like, that was happening. And there used to be a lot of, like, Ms. parties. They were, like, Ms. born, but they were totally they were fun, and... Mm-hmm.
I know it is so hard
now to believe, like, that happened.
That's weird that we all used to hang out together
and
all the
time.
And we
did that, like that we were excited to.
And we loved it, yeah.
And then, you know, we had both been working on separate book ideas, and then just one, as we say, drunk a night, just were like, yeah, let's do this book together. Like, why don't we do one book together? Mm-hmm. And I think even at the time we weren't clear on how we were going to write a book together mm-hmm. and even how our ideas were going to come together, but it very quickly became obvious, and then it was so easy to write Grassroots after having written Manifesta, and now when we write things together, it's very easy for us to find our commonality, and many people will say about Manifesta, oh, it reads like a conversation, I feel like I'm a part of it, and I think it's because that was very much how it was written, and I think that we both came to Manifesta with very specific ideas about how things were, but then in kind of vetting them through the other person, we're like, oh, you're right, that is kind of weak, wait, that's right, that is a contradiction.
What about this?
Yeah. Yeah, how about...
We grew a lot in our combined thinking. And I think we came to it also thinking we both probably had the same thoughts about things and realizing how diverse our impressions were and what and our knowledge bases and like what were the things that we had expertise in, how they came together. So that was really cool. And I do remember in a way that just doesn't happen anymore, and not because like we're afraid to have it happen, it just doesn't happen because we just have so much time to like talk about things. I remember that we did have this one, it was almost like an argument about where the direction something should go, and it had to do with the mother's chapter, and I think I was dealing with my own like anger towards certain people, especially this woman, Phyllis Chesler.
Yeah, I know, I was like, all I can remember is about Phyllis Chesler.
Yeah, and Amy felt less incensed by it, for sure. And I kept being like, but I was sort of presenting it not personally, but as like, no, I mean, the truth of the matter is we have to present it this way because that's the truth or whatever. And finally she was like, well, you seem to like really care about this a lot more than I do, so you can have it go the way you do. But it really, and it was kind of this like awkward standoff. And then it sort of did go that way. We sort of went with my way of doing it. And now looking back, I see how personal that was. Mm-hmm. And in some ways kind of wish, I mean, I'm glad it's out there just because it was true at the time or whatever for me, and I think maybe other people felt it, but there was a way in which it wasn't necessarily what I would want to have the takeaway of that chapter be. It gave her a lot of power. That was the thing I think I probably didn't realize, is in my inability to get over slights and her egotism, I made her bigger than she needed to be in our book. And so anyway, even the things that were that ended up being sort of mistakes, I think, were big, like, learning moments for the two of us. And we had to spend so much time together. Like, literally, I'm amazed at how infrequently we argue, given how much time we have to spend together. Mm-hmm. Like, it would be, like, overnight after overnight after overnight, and then meals together, because we really
and
had to,
sleep
like,
deprived on top of it.
Yeah. And the amount of slap-happy conversations and, like, laughing and, like, gorging on, like, really disgusting food because we can't leave the apartment and that whole thing, that writer thing of, like, you write this whole chapter and you think it's pretty good and then you read it and realize it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, we had so many experiences like that, so many technical malfunctions where it was, like, a lot harder to print things out back then for us.
I know. And even a lot, like, she's a Mac person, I'm a PC person.
Yeah,
like,
no, hard, we couldn't
like,
email each other.
Like, it was, like, hard to... But I do think that, and I think, you know, overall Manifesto was a great experience, and this is more applicable to our work with Soapbox, mm-hmm. is that I think we're both hardworking, responsible people, and I think that that is what keeps the relationship going, because I've been in other partnerships where I'm pulling all the weight, and other relationships that I'm bitter that I'm there, you know, mm-hmm. and that I don't pull my weight, because I just don't want to be there, mm-hmm. and I feel like somebody's forcing me to be there, but I think that it is, but I think that the shared sort of work ethic, also keeps, you know, and that was true with the writing Manifesto, but it's also true with, like, Soapbox and the other things we've done together.
And we still have good ideas together. That's the thing that I'm always like,
yeah,
we're going to come a day when we're like, because we've totally deviated and done our own projects, but we like doing things together. And it's like, is there going to come a day when we just don't have a mutual idea anymore, where we're like, no, I don't think that is a good idea.
Yeah.
You just do that or something. Like, it's hard to imagine, but it could happen.
What is one issue you two differ on? As politically or...
It's weird. It's more like on every issue we have slightly different viewpoints, but we haven't, I mean, I feel like I have totally taken on, I feel like I understand and respect the differences, yeah. and so they become part of my story, too.
Well, there's, you know, when we were writing Manifesta, and in hindsight, I think this was right on, but I think I needed another example to make it make sense in my own life. Jennifer was really aware of the impact of culture over young people's lives, and specifically using Bust magazine and that as a... And I didn't totally get it in my own life, but then when I read Carol Gilligan and when we interviewed Carol Gilligan, who said the same thing, but what was it was being said in a more
academic
theoretical way, I got it all of a sudden, but I needed that. And I'm just not a culture person. Like, I'm not a music movie. I mean, I have some of that, but it's not...
That's true. I was super focused on pop culture.
And I was so much more, like, old-school political in a way, where I was like, Bust doesn't have any politics. Like, I can't take it seriously. But I think now I'm like, oh, my gosh, where does traditional politics get you anyway? Like,
yeah, I guess that's true. We had different orientations. And sometimes, you know, one of us will be more interested in an issue than another person, or we'll just have more experience. Amy's traveled, done a lot more international feminist stuff than I have. Like, and so... I'm often in a learning position, you know, when we talk about those things, although I feel like I can discuss them. It's not through direct experience as much as it is for her. I have more experience with, like, actually writing for magazines, so if we're kind of bitching about the media, I have, like, a different... Or not even bitching about it, but just have a different angle in. I wanted to be an actor, you know. I dated a touring musician for a long time, so I have, like, this different angle on that lifestyle, you know. Amy's relationship, she's on a lot of boards, so she has a different relationship to foundation work. And so I think we have different things where hopefully we acknowledge each other's more direct connection, and then that person is a little bit more the leader in terms of developing theories about it, but the other person is involved.
And together that makes an all-encompassing package.
It's pretty encompassing. It's funny when people are like, you know, but you're just two middle-class white women or whatever, because...
God, you got that a lot here.
Yeah, well,
today and yesterday.
Because on some level we are.
But it also tends to come up in spaces that are
more white,
middle class.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
When you go to more
projection.
Diverse. Yeah.
I think, like, looking in your own community and finding some sort of entry point to connecting with your own community about things that need to change, to me, is very, very powerful.
But there's ways in which people that are below us have better lives than we have. You know, if there's the more money a family has, the greater the discrepancies are between men and women, because there's that much more at stake, and so the more need to keep women down. And so in poorer families, there's often more equality in relationships and in families, because there's less at stake. And so I think it's in some ways short-sighted to assume that people below don't have things that we can benefit from. But I also think sexual abuse happens across incomes. Rape happens across... Body image happens across income. You know,
Domestic violence.
There's all these things that are not income dependent. I think that, again, we sort of assume they are because upper class people know how to hide a little bit better or have... Because they don't want to expose their families. And so there's, like... They know it's going to hurt them if they expose their families, whereas other people... There's a great book by Michelle Fine called The Unknown... and Lois Wise, called The Unknown City, and it looks at three communities, and they're all working class communities, but one is heavily black, and one heavily Latina, and one is heavily white, but all very similar income brackets, and how each of them respond to different social issues, like domestic violence and rape, and is radically different. Like, the white people are like, we need services, we need this, where the Latina women are like, this is so not a big deal. Like, I have so many other things going on, and I don't want my family to be further marginalized in this community. And black women are like, yeah, he hit me, so what? And so it's so interesting to sort of take somewhat homogeneous in terms of income and the issues that are affecting you, but how radically different they manifest in those communities. I also think that the minute you start looking globally, there's so much we can learn from globally. You know, in the United States, you know, I was just in Russia, and I'm going back to Russia, and in many ways, communist Russia was what feminists of the 70s wanted. You know, sort of like, we want state-based childcare, we want state-based healthcare, we want all these things. And you go to Russia, and the status of women is not great. It's, in fact, worse. Like, statistically, like, the violence rate is much higher, all these things are higher, and you're like...
Yeah,
and
much
so
worse.
To learn from that, to be like, is that really what we want in this country? Because look at... and in that country. There are many countries around the world that have much better representation of women in leadership than the United States does. Mm-hmm. And it's in part because they've updated their constitutions. They will put in their constitutions, like South Africa, mm-hmm. certain number of women, India, certain number of women should be in parliament. And they've mandated it. And so to assume that we somehow, and those are southern developing countries, and the fact that we don't have that in this country. And I think there's just a general, there's also something else. The second you go globally, I think people think that, you know, I was saying this earlier, that in the United States, I think we have a harder time helping poor people because we think that they deserve it or they asked for it or because there's the American dream.
It's a meritocracy,
they
yeah.
could get out of it if they wanted to, but they're just being lazy or they could, whereas in other countries, it's like, no, that's the circumstance of that country. They're poor. They can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a wrong assumption. But I do think that there is as much poverty in this country as there is abroad. Maybe not as nationalized, but I think there's as much poverty. And I think the one thing that they have abroad is most countries do have health care. Most people do have a basic standard of education, you know, and that we don't, in the United States, it's impossible to have subsistence living. In countries around the world, there is a sense of traditional, like tribalism in some places, and so there's that collective feeling, and so you can have nothing, but there's no sense of land ownership, so you don't need to own the land, you know what I mean? And then you come to this country, and you're like, no, but how are you paying your rent? It's like, what? Rent? You know, so I just think it's so different in other places of the world, it's kind of hard to say. Because do we want them all to have home ownership? Is that going to make the situation better? Like, are we going to give them the things that work well in this country? And it's not going to work, you know?
And I think that can be a really valid critique if that, in fact, then leads itself to some sort of action. Just to make it to undermine the contributions of people who have white skin privilege or whatever.
There's lots that can be done in our own communities if we're willing to look. I mean, that's, I think, the harder thing about looking closer is the more we feel the issue and we're like, oh no, now I have to, the more you feel your privilege in some ways because you're like, oh my gosh, am I being able to have an education that's best for my kids means that that family can't get educated in a way that's best for them. Mm-hmm. And so am I willing to compromise? Am I willing to give up a teacher to be the bilingual teacher, which maybe means my kid won't be getting all the resources? And, so I do think there's tons of things right in front.
This is one question I always like asking people that are politically engaged. Is if you would have had the power to put anything on the ballot in the last election, what would it have been? What issue?
I probably would have put something on the ballot that had to do with voting rights because I still think we're so behind in terms of what percentage of people vote. And it probably would have been a voting ballot to make every state like same-day registration or like they do in Texas where you can register the early voting, but that it's 2 weeks before you can register, or like Oregon, actually probably do what Oregon does, which is to make it mail-in ballots because Oregon has considerably higher voter turnout than any other state, like 80-some percent, and it's because of the mail-in ballot. So I probably would have done something that was about voter reform.
I guess the one thing I've thought of that might be good, I mean, because of course I want all the things everyone wants, I want health care reform and all that sort of stuff, but I think that in the same way that we have a Peace Corps and we have AmeriCorps, or maybe these things could be used in this different way domestically, I think there should be some sort of care corps, because we do have people who are taking care of parents and children simultaneously, and that is a very almost impossible role to be in. And so if we had young people like your age just out of college where they could get some sort of stipend, but their job was to be really super invested in a community and provide care, whether it be child care or elder care, so that people can like just sort of like have their life work and have people not slip through the cracks. I think that would be something I could get behind, a care for.
You listen to an interview with Jennifer Baumgartner and Amy Richards. To learn more about them, go to their website, www.soapboxinc.com. That is www.soapboxinc.com.
Anna Maria Roque spoke with Amy Richards and Jennifer Baumgartner, authors of Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future, in spring of 2009. We have a double theme this week on Yin Radio. This show features work produced by Anna Maria Roque, and all of the segments focus on feminism. Installment number two. Kathy Aiken is the Dean of the College of Letters, Arts, and Social Science at the University of Idaho. She's the first woman to hold that post in the university's 120-year history. Anna Madaya spoke to Dean Kathy Aiken for Yin Radio.
Kathy Aiken is the Dean of College of Letters, Arts, and Social Sciences at the University of Idaho, the first woman in that role, and one of the few women in the professional circles she works in on campus. I talked to Kathy Aiken about women on colleges in the 1970s as well as today.
When I was an undergraduate, women students were required to take a course called Healthful Living. Not men students, but all the women students had to take that course in order to graduate. And it had things like some basic nutrition, some what I would call sort of sex ed, some kind of family and marriage sort of issues. It was a very interesting process. And yeah, I didn't really learn about now and consciousness raising and the feminine mystique till I went to graduate school after I left the University of Idaho, which I actually did, although I'm in the class of 73. I finished here in spring of 1972. The University of Idaho was a little bit behind other places in terms of the timing of all of that.
Okay. I see a lot of like feminist things in your office. Would you consider yourself feminist?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, I would. And I think I teach a lot of that, and I think there are a number of people that teach that now, but I think that was not something that people would have felt comfortable discussing in the classroom when I was a student. I think they would have worried about their career situation.
But now that you're back here at U of I, tell me a little bit about the differences.
Well, when I think about being a all my students have heard me say this a number of times. History is my discipline. And if you walk up the stairs on the third floor of this building, you will see the professors emeritus of history's photographs there. And I now have enough time that I would be, even if I left tomorrow, I'll be the first woman there. And there have been historians since we started the university in 1889. So that says something about the nature of the climate for women. And when I look at, even in this college now, at the full professors, I think there are only five or six women full professors in this whole college at this moment. And there's not a single woman chair in my own college. And so things have changed, but there is a woman dean, which there never was before. So
you're the first woman dean?
First woman dean. First tenured woman in history, first woman chair in history, first woman dean in this college. And you would think, I mean, it is 2008, that wouldn't be the case, it seems like to me. So we still have some issues. And whenever we survey women and ask about climate, it's clear that we have some climate issues for women at the University of Idaho, even at this point.
Elaborate. How so?
Well, we don't really have women in, like, in the key leadership positions, like presidents or vice presidents. I think women feel vulnerable at tenure and promotion time. I think they feel vulnerable in a number of staff and academic settings. I think they feel that I think they feel that it's much more difficult to be a woman in either a faculty or staff position at the University of Idaho than it is to be a man. And I think they're right. Even now. Even now. One of the things I used to teach was women's history, but when I teach, I think students think that issues involving gender are over and won, and I think when they get into the workplace, they find that that is not the case.
Do you see any movement, women speaking up about this?
I think women speak up, and I think, I mean, there are a lot more women. Like, the history department has two women now, and when I was there, three. So at least it's a lot different to be by yourself than to have some others.
Sure.
And so I think that has really changed. But I sit on the president's cabinet, and there are only a couple of women there and this whole big room of men. And even at the Provost Council, which is deans and some other folks, there aren't very many women there. Certainly we're a distinct minority there still. And you just can't help but notice that. No?
Sure. For students, though, it's gone significantly better.
Yes, because there are a lot more students. Right. And women, I think, are at least pretty close to equal. Yeah.
How did you change?
I think I always sort of had a hint about it. And I think a lot has to do with my father was a small-town attorney, and he was pretty clear that I should pursue whatever career path I wanted, and so I think that was helpful. But I literally read The Feminine Mystique and had an epiphany, and I'm not the only one.
No.
And so, and I mean, I can distinctly remember reading it and thinking, whoa.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
I was reading how the student dropout rate for women was 51%.
Right.
And they did a survey at the time, I think it was 72 when they did this, and they found out that they thought that was for marital reasons. Well, 18% was, in fact, dropping out to get married. The rest, though, overwhelmingly felt pressured and confused. They felt confused that they didn't know what the women's role was. Did you feel like that?
I think that's true. And one of the places I really remember it is I took an upper division political science class of some sort, administrative law or something, and there were probably about 25 people in it, and I was the only woman. And I can remember sitting in that class, and the professor was male, and they were male, and the exchanges, and that somehow I really didn't fit. I mean, it was just so obvious when that's the situation. And I think professors at that time they were all male in the disciplines that I primarily took courses in, weren't exactly sure what to do with women students either in terms of how to advise them or how to think about them having careers. And so I think that was just very difficult.
Yeah, the survey showed that these women, all pretty much all women, they surveyed all the women here at the UI at the time. And they said that all women felt discriminated or pressured against in either one of the categories, one of which was advising. And they said that they were literally being channeled in the four major fields, which, you know, social science,
teaching,
health, education.
I think that's true. And what now did University of Oregon and elsewhere was its primary work was explaining to women that they weren't alone in these feelings, that they had all those questions that you said that people had in the survey about feeling like they were sort of disenfranchised. The problem was people thought that it was something a matter with them and that they were the only ones that felt this way. And now spend a lot of time, you know, talking to people about how, well, not only do you feel that way, but all these other people feel that way, and this is why. And I think that's a really liberating kind of experience. And then they started to look at one of the things that NOW did in the first chapter that I worked, all of the newspaper advertisements for employment were listed jobs for women, and then there were ads, and then jobs for men, and then there were ads. And they worked really hard, which seems so, to change that so that they're just
jobs.
These are jobs, and whoever is qualified could apply for those jobs. And they worked for a long time. There's a lot of discussion about changing that, both on the part of the newspaper and people who wrote letters to the editor and all of that. So that's one of the things that NOW did that seems so small now is talked about using MS as a form of address, and that was a big topic of discussion at the time, which now nobody gives much thought to that at all, but it was a big sort of change.
Same thing, if I look back in newspapers from that time, it's Mrs., Henry Williams.
Yep, like people have no names
like
of their
own. Like they
don't
have a identity of their own, yeah.
Discuss that a lot on this campus even now. I'm really convinced that people's name, it does matter. I think using him instead of her all the time, it does matter. People say that's such a small thing. Well, it isn't really a small thing. And my answer is, if it's a small thing, then let's just use her for everything. If it really doesn't matter, then why not do it that way? And, of course, that's not what they have in mind. But, for example, I mean, I'll say it publicly. We have this big event where we honor donors. Mm-hmm. And we list the donors if both of them graduate from the University of Idaho with the man's name first. If it's a couple. And, you know, I said to him, well, that's all well and good, but, and I adore my husband, who's a Vandal of 35 years, but, you know, this donation comes out of my paycheck. I really think I ought to get my name first. Is that really asking that much? And, it, you know, it's not a big deal, but it sends a message, I think, and it's a real obvious one. And so those kind of things, I think we could
work change on. Them. So you touched on the name use and the administration being still unequal. Anything else you see on campus?
Well,
how about
I
equal pay?
Pay is equal at entry level. I mean, we have done a really good job. When you ask about some of the things that have changed, we have done a really good job of paying men and women totally equally at the time they enter. And so in theory, if we all just should live long enough, equal pay issues at a place like the University of Idaho should resolve themselves, because if we start everybody equal, then it should eventually get there. We aren't there yet. We still have anomalies that are just from at the time of hire, where you can't fix that, and other kinds of equity issues. I think we're a lot more cognizant of it. When we have money, we try to address really serious discrepancies, but we still have some of that. I also think one of my big fears, it's a big topic of conversation in academia, is that women, we do fine about getting professorial jobs, but women often choose not to jump through all the hoops that it takes to get tenure and then to get promoted to full professor. And I think that's a real loss. I mean, they just tend to, not that they can't be successful, they just say, why would I possibly want to do all of those things in order? I would rather do something else. That really worries me, and that's the issue across disciplines. There's a lot of discussion about that in academic journals and elsewhere, that, you know, it's maybe you remember all the flap about the president of Harvard saying women can't be scientists. And, I mean, it continues to be this real problem, in that we really increased the number of women we hire, and in some we're getting to where we hire more women than men, but we are not getting women to the full professor level in anywhere near the numbers that we get men there.
Do you think it has anything to do with the women, you know, taking leave and
families? Mean, sometimes it's family issues. I mean, one of the things that when I was chair of history that I worked on and that we worked on is a family leave policy, even, that stops your tenure clock. But it's still not perfect, and you still have to, it's not automatic. You have to ask, and I have issues with that. And it is, women take time off for families. Or even more troublesome to me is that women, I think it's fine. I think people should choose about having children if they want to. But it really bothers me that women say the choice is either their career or to have those children, that they can't do both of those things. And I don't think that's fair. I mean, men don't have to make that choice, and we need to figure out a way to facilitate women's process so that they don't think that that's the choice that they have to make. I don't think that's good for society. I don't think that's good for us as an academic community for women to feel that kind of pressure.
Oh. Did you feel, is there still like that struggle where you try to compete with men?
Well, I hate to think about competing, but it shouldn't be a competition, but it's a fine line, and I think in all the years of my career I've struggled with it. Do you play the game that men have established in order to get to be the dean so that then you can do something about it, or do you refuse to play? And I don't know what the right answer to that. I still don't know what the right answer to that is. But I know in my own career that I have at sometimes made compromises in order to get where I thought I needed to go.
Sure.
And sometimes I wonder, okay, well, was that the right call, or should I have done that differently? But the men still control the game, and you either decide you're going to play that game and play it as well or better, mm-hmm. or you aren't going to play it. We aren't to the point where we get to say, let's make it a different game. We aren't there yet.
No. Women in the 70s, what they did, it was like they'd be doing, you know, teaching and doing what men were doing, just in a feminine way, and they would at all times still wear a skirt to maintain that femininity. Do you still see that today? I mean, you're wearing a skirt.
Yeah, I wear skirts, so primarily because I like skirts. Actually,
okay.
I look better in skirts, such as it is. You know what I mean? It's like a. It's just,
you're not making a statement.
No,
by wearing
it's
skirts.
Just okay. I always wear, but I am really conscious. And one of my colleagues, Lynn Baird, who's dean of the library, I'm really conscious of dressing in a certain way that conveys sort of position. I mean, I think women have to pay a lot more attention to that maybe sometimes than men do. Although, if you look at Steve Daly Larson, when he's doing public kind of work, he's pretty careful about being dressed in a certain
sure.
way, because I think that's just kind of one of the things that
right.
you have to do. And I guess Hillary Rodham Clinton, I mean, she does pants. You can, I just have never been very good at pants.
Yeah.
I think I'll just offer. It's because I'm sort of taller and long. I don't know.
It's not like, you know,
no,
I'm a woman.
Like,
but
no, I've got to wear a skirt. It's just I never really, I don't look that good in pants.
Well, that's
okay. It's easy when you get, now that I'm kind of towards the end of my career, sometimes I get discouraged because I think there's still a lot of work to do, but other times I think, boy, we women really have accomplished a lot. And in what, from, as a historian, is a relatively short period of time, actually.
Dean Kathy Aiken. She is the dean of the College of Letters, Arts, and Sciences at the University of Idaho, and she spoke with Anna Maria in fall 2008. Installment number 3 sticks with our double theme of Anna Maria's work for Yin Radio and of feminism. It's an essay that Anna Maria wrote and read about her own feminist hero, Inez Mulholland.
One of those suffragettes is a personal feminist heroine of mine, and here is her story. My feminist heroine is Inez Mulholland, also known as the woman on the horse that led the suffragists in the March for Women's Rights. Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? Those were her last public words before she suffered a sudden collapse from pernicious anemia while delivering a speech in California. Suffragist, lawyer, athlete, activist, public speaker, and World War I news correspondent. She was a remarkable woman indeed. Born in Brooklyn, New York on August 6, 1886, she was the eldest daughter of John and Jean Mulholland. Her father was a New York Tribune reporter and editorial writer, who eventually headed a pneumatic tubes business that provided his family a privileged life in both New York and London. Much of Mulholland's adolescence was spent in the family's London home, and for most of her life she carried a faint British accent, which added to her charm. In London, she attended the Kensington High School for Girls, a private school noted for its freedom from class distinctions and allowing social classes to mix, perhaps fueling to Mulholland's later efforts toward class equity. After attending a school in Berlin, Germany, Mulholland enrolled at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, At Vassar, Mulholland pursued herself hard. Trying to get all she could out of her college experience, Mulholland played many roles in student productions, was part of her current topics club, the German club, and the debating team, as well as the unrecognized but active socialist club. Mulholland was also a recognized athlete, and in her junior year won the College Cup for best all-around athlete. During a trip home in London, she was transformed into an ardent political radical when she met the aristocratic suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst. With Pankhurst, she participated in a number of demonstrations in England, and upon returning to Vassar, she wrote in the Vassar Miscellany, the school newspaper, about the English suffragettes, noting the disappointing efforts of American women by comparison. Mulholland was determined to bring women's suffrage to Vassar College, and when the college refused women's suffrage speakers to come to campus, she was outraged and took action. She organized a rally on the cemetery barely outside campus boundaries, where the speakers could be heard. By the time Mulholland graduated, two-thirds of the student body belonged to the women's suffrage group she created. After graduation, Mulholland applied to law schools at Yale, Harvard, and Columbia, but was rejected on basis of her gender. Eventually, she entered the New York University School of Law, from which she received her law degree. During her studies, Mulholland continued her suffrage work, as well as other social activism, most notably participating in the shirtwaist and laundry worker strikes in New York City, for which she was arrested. She quickly gained a reputation as one of the most powerful, persuasive, and beautiful orators in the suffrage movement. Her most memorable public appearance was on March 3, 1913, in the Women's Suffrage Parade, the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration, when Mulholland cemented her charismatic identity by leading the parade, wearing a crown and a long white cape while riding atop a large white horse. Later that year, Mulholland met and married the Dutch coffee importer Eugène Jan Boisvin, to whom she proposed, by the way. The marriage between the two was by no means traditional. Both believed in free love, and Eugène's powerful but self-deprecating personality was always present to support and encourage his wife in her endeavors. In 1915, Mulholland diverted her efforts when she joined the Ford Peace Ship in an effort to stop World War I through neutral peace negotiations. During this time, she also served as a war correspondent until she was expelled from her position for her pacifist views. Upon returning to the US, Mulholland continued her work for suffrage and joined the National Women's Party. Delivering an address on the suffrage store in LA on 19 October 1916, Mulholland suddenly collapsed. She was hospitalized, and 10 weeks later, on November 25, 1916, the 30-year-old activist died of pernicious anemia. She had known she had a potential deadly disease, but stubbornly continued her fight for the cause. Dedicated to social equity, regardless of class or gender, Inés Mulholland was a woman, willing to champion the causes of anyone. Women, laborers, children, or the poor, who found themselves disenfranchised.
Falling while the cars are burning, and I'm here with this pain in my chest. The moon is crying while the sky is dying. This is why I can't rest. So I sing, whoa. Tell me any lies, this is why I can rest a sing whoa, 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 whoa. I have three holes in my rucksack and they put in black and I hold a self-check in my hand. I let my legs to my thoughts, just trying to not be cold. This is why I can't rest, so I sing whoa, 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 whoa.
Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show. You can listen to past shows or podcast this show or sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio@vpfound.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat, and we're closing this show with music by Janie Snyder. It's a song called This Is Why I Can't Rest. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, and thanks for joining me. Until next week.